It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 376 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, it's another doubleheader and Kickstarter weekend. We've got two great projects that are worthy of your support. And I have to say, in my opinion, these are both exceptional ones. I never bring up a book that I don't think is great, but these two are really terrific ones. First up is Mark Gaffin and Daniel Govar, two of the creators of a wonderful book called Tuskers. It's a graphic novel about a herd of orphaned African elephants that must escape their homeland as a vicious poaching militia chases them. We talk about how the project has already met its goal, but there are wonderful stretch goals coming. So now is the time to jump on, especially if you're interested in elephants or the environment or anything like that. I would definitely go to Kickstarter and look for Tuskers, T-U-S-K-E-R-S. Then everything wraps up with Tokyo Rose Zero Hour, and I talk with one of the writers, Andre Frattino, and one of the folks behind their Kickstarter, Andrew Burkett. We talk about how this book came to be, and a little bit about the person we know from World War II, and we learn about her story, and I come away really intrigued and really fascinated to get this book. So if you go to Kickstarter, it's Tokyo Rose :Zero Hour. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show.
Hi guys, I'm writer Javier Barrios.
And I'm the other writer, Mark Gaffin. And we're here to ask for your support for a graphic novel that's close to our hearts. Tuskers is an adventure story about a herd of orphan African elephants that must escape a vicious poaching militia in South Sudan to the safety of an animal sanctuary hundreds of miles away in Kenya. Guiding them on this journey is a group of wildlife rangers who are risking their own lives to help a cause that's bigger than themselves. It's in the vein of a really exciting Western.
Hi, I'm artist Daniel Govar. What got me excited to collaborate on this project was our characters. Our main elephant orphans who become an unlikely herd because of the poaching of their families. Detroit, Asampu, Roy, and their matriarch Daphne. And then there are our humans. Dr. Zuri Arrivo, the caretaker of the orphanage. Disgraced Army Ranger, Elias Delgado, who's seeking redemption. The Eco Guards, members of a conservationist group who risk their lives by protecting the elephants. And then there's our villain, a vicious warlord named Katumba, who wants to sell the elephants' ivory tusks to pay for weapons and power. The graphic novel will be 128 pages. And we're already a quarter of the way there. The color palette will be black and white, with an orange that sets the tone for our adventure and allows us to convey the vastness of the landscapes.
We've set out to create a story that would not just entertain, but also motivate and educate readers to get involved in the special cause to stop elephant poaching. That's what great stories have the power to do.
It's great to welcome to the podcast Mark Gaffin and Daniel Govar, two of the creators behind Tuskers, which is available now on Kickstarter, which is a wonderful story that's already pulling on the heartstrings. How are you doing today, Mark?
I'm good. Thank you for having us.
Well, it's good to talk with you. And Daniel, how about you?
Oh, I'm swell.
Good, good. Well, let's... Tuskers, I got to read the description in here. It's on the Kickstarter because it just got me. It says a graphic novel about a herd of orphaned African elephants that must escape their homeland as a vicious poaching militia chases them. Orphaned. Not bad enough there are African elephants who are already in trouble and stuff, but now they're orphaned ones too. You really made it so that it's going to get us to get, I'm going to sit there and go, oh, because I got to know what happened to these things, because this is such a great thing about that. So, well, Mark, why don't we start talking with you, and we'll ask, how did this project well, I saw this on the video on there, it talks about it, but why don't you kind of reiterate a little bit as to how this project got started?
Sure, happy to. Myself and my co-writer, Javier Barrios, we kind of came at it at like a parallel lines where maybe about 5 years ago, I saw this amazing piece on 60 Minutes by Bob Simon about him going to an elephant orphanage run by the Daphne Sheldrick and the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. And this basically told the story about how poaching is basically decimating all the elephants in Africa and leaving all these orphans behind. And if the baby elephants don't have milk or anyone to protect them, they'll be dead within days. And these orphanages, these conservationists rush out, grab the baby elephant, bring them back to this sanctuary and raise them and take care of them. And you get to see that elephants are such emotionally intelligent creatures. They care, they laugh, they play, they cry, and basically they're now without a family. And it just, this piece really, really touched me. Mm-hmm. And during that same time, Javier, my co-writer, who couldn't be with us today, he has 2 20-year-old daughters who are about 5 years old at that time, and they're obsessed with elephants. They'd always have them go on the internet and find stuff about elephants. And he came across a story that way by finding about the poaching crisis that's happening. And we just started talking and saying, this is just so tragic. We wish there was something we could do. And we said to ourselves, wait a second, we're both writers. Let's find the story in here and bring awareness to this and also tell a really good story, kind of like how gorillas in the mist basically opened the eyes for people for the gorilla poaching back in Africa back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's the look of it is just tremendous to me. Well, talk about why it's called Tuskers. Why that name?
Sure. So basically, an elephant tusk, it's of course, it's the big ivory protruding from their face, and it's pretty much like a fingernail. And basically, elephants that have very large tusks that basically go from their face all the way down to the ground, they have a nickname in Africa, and they're called Tuskers. Mm. And it's a way of describing an animal and its prominence, because usually Tuskers are the patriarch of the herd, and it's just a proud way of saying, look at that Tusker over there.
Interesting. Okay, so that's where the name comes from. So you guys got together and kind of brought this together. Why a graphic novel? Why a comic instead of, like, say, a TV show or something?
Well, that's a good thing. That's what we originally thought, because I work in TV. I'm a writer for television. I've worked on shows such as Grimm, or right now I'm on New Amsterdam. And Javier works for the Writers Guild, and he's a feature writer for social conscious issues. And we were trying to figure out the best way to write this. And we just thought, a graphic novel, not only do you get to tell an interesting story, but you can tell from different points of view that you can't normally do with a live-action TV show or a movie. Because part of our tale is told from the elephant's point of view, and part of it's also told from the animal conservationists who are trying to save and rescue these animals and lead them from basically point A to point B, like a really good Western, cattle herd Western movie. And the graphic novel can really basically showcase all points of views that you can't do in live-action films, because you know the elephants are the main characters. The elephants are not the side characters. It should be told mostly from their point of view, so you can basically get inside their emotional core and figure out what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm. That's really good. Now, Daniel, how'd you get involved in the project?
Oh, interestingly, I have worked with Mark once before on Grimm for Dynamite, another graphic novel that and that was a one shot, I believe, right? It was a one shot, but it was like a 60-page story that kind of expanded upon the Grimm TV show. Mm-hmm. So we had worked before, and he approached me, said, "Hey, we have this project, but we don't really have an artist attached, and you were kind of our first choice." And I was kind of busy at the time doing, funny enough, a kid's book about elephants. And I looked it over, and honestly, the story really got me. And I'm really big into wildlife, and my son is too, who's 3 years old. Mm-hmm. We go to the zoo at least once a week. And he always makes it a point to, you know, call all the animals his friends. He thinks that they're literally his buddies. It was one of those, this is something that, you know, is really worthwhile and necessary.
The reason why I love working with Daniel is his art really does bring out the emotion in all the characters, where the art is just not combined to your basic comic book panels. They go outside the panels and have great depth and great movement to them, even though, of course, it's still images. It's just he has a very unique perspective when he draws. And we found that out when I worked with him on Grimm, and it really comes to life beautifully with the with these great African savannas and the use of elephants and people interacting with each other. It's really beautiful to see.
Well, I really appreciate that.
Well, there is one image right away on the Kickstarter page. The first image you see when you scroll down past the video, there is an elephant, and there is this Dr. Arrivo. I'm probably mispronouncing that. But she is there, and she's got her hand on the tusk.
On Daphne's single tusk.
Yeah, and then also on the other on the trunk, she's got that. And I am just touched looking at that. I mean, I just... You know, she's got her head down like sympathy and stuff, and the elephant lets her do that. I was so moved when I saw that. That is just a really great, really wonderful illustration. That's not a photo thing, right? You did that from your own imagination.
That was actually really cool. We wanted to do something that was a thank you when we hit our goal, and I was like, yeah, I'll whip something out that has that, you know, that moment that we were looking for. So, yeah.
That's really lovely.
And Daniel has such great detail that if you scroll down to the pages, if you ever visit the site, there's a shot of Zuri Arrivo standing over a baby elephant who just witnessed his whole family get massacred for their ivory. And she puts her hands on the baby elephant's heart and stomach just to feel him breathe, to make sure, you know, he knows that she's there. And the detail he has is the panel before she's wearing gloves. You see her take off the gloves and you see her put her bare hands on the heart. It really comes together like you're watching a real motion, a human emotion and human motion, not just still images. And I think that type of detail is fantastic.
Yeah, I have to ask, too, about the use of black and white and color. It's you've kind of got, you know, black and white mostly images, but then, like I said, the backgrounds and some other things are mostly like oranges and things like that. Why was that?
That's a good question. So when Mark first approached me about doing it, he was like, you know, we kind of want to do it in a black and white format. And I thought that was great. I think black and white lends something to the imagination when you're reading it, that, you know, color just kind of... You know, it's too in your face sometimes and kind of takes you out of the story in a way. And the more I started looking at it and the more I started looking at other black and white stories, I was looking at things like Sin City, a lot of Frank Miller stuff, where he's really good at doing these stark contrast black and white stories with a hit color, usually red. And we didn't want ours to have that same sort of red kind of, you know, tone, but we wanted it to be able to show these vast landscapes and these, you know, sweeping skies and things like that. And we tried, I actually played around with different colors, but orange was the one that immediately I was like, yeah, this says Africa to me. It has that feeling. And just by looking at the images, it was what we were looking for, I think.
Mm-hmm. Daniel uses watercolors for a lot of this, and his brush
strokes. It's all watercolor, yeah.
It's all watercolor, and so it's a very specific type of orange that's really comes off the page. And it looks so beautiful and different from anything that you normally see out there right now, which really grabs my attention when I look at it. Which is as a comic book fan and a comic book nerd, you know, just to see a watercolor graphic novel. It's unique and really interesting.
Well, I've also got to say something about the faces, because I usually judge artwork by like two things, like action sequences and how they're presented and facial expressions. And the facial expressions of Katoomba, I wanted to reach through and punch just with the...
That's great. He's our villain.
Good.
The smile on there is just that evil smile. I mean, it's not just a regular old smile. Yeah. It's an evil smile when he does it. And I'm just like, oh, rotten, no good kind of stuff, you know, because that's beautifully done in the artwork, I have to say.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, he's definitely despicable. I love some of the scenes with him in Detroit, which I think we actually put some of those up. And those are really fun. Detroit, the young baby elephant, the infant, really kind of puts him in his place sometimes. So,
Mm-hmm. Well, the sad thing story-wise about Katoomba is when Javier and I were first wrote this, we had the idea that
The backstory.
Yeah, that he's a warlord in South Sudan, and we came up with the idea kind of based upon tons of research about what's really happening there, about how he wants to take these elephants from the orphanage and start his own elephant farm where he can basically raise them from babies until they get older and they have large tusks, and kill them once they have the large tusks and breed the rest of them to keep his supply of ivory constant. And people always said to us, keep the militia alive to pay for weapons and power by raising these ivory like you do like cattle for beef. And people would always say to us, that's too far-fetched. That would never happen. And then
it does.
And then it does. And then just this year, it was announced that places in China are opening up tiger farms and rhino farms and pangolin farms just to do that, to raise these creatures up in order to take their bones or their horns, the scales, and use them for medicine.
I read that article, and they were talking how it was mainly to keep up with demand, because they realized that Africa is a finite resource. And they were like, you know what? Maybe we should just start our own. I mean, it's crazy to think about.
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, sometimes in a comic, you do things that might be real.
Well, in this case, we were really going for that, though. We really didn't want to pull any punches with, some of the imagery. And this is another reason that I think the hit color was a really good color, choosing that orange versus a red. We did want to have some of those violent scenes in there. We didn't want to sugarcoat. We didn't want to hide it. We want it to kind of be your face, because it really is in your face when you're there.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
It's a totally different feel.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we originally thought black and white until Daniel had this genius idea of going with the orange, is because we didn't want to tell a Disney story about the African elephant poaching crisis. Mm. We wanted to show the horrors of what's really happening so people become aware of it and realize what is really, really happening. And of course, the story is told from a baby elephant named Detroit, whose name has significance later on. And Detroit finds hope and peace and forgiveness throughout his journey. But we wanted to begin by really opening people's eyes to the horrors of how ivory is really harnessed by the killing and how it's done. And from there, bring the story of hope. But in order to get to hope, you have to show a realistic view of what's really happening in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've got to ask, though, as far as you're talking about the story centering around the elephants, but I don't see thought balloons anywhere in there or them speaking to each other, as often happens in comics. There are banners talking about some of the things, like a narrator going on, but you don't have that. So that's, of course, that puts a challenge on you, Daniel, as far as that goes, because you've got to show the expressions on these elephants' faces. I mean, was that a challenge to you to do that?
A huge challenge. That was actually one of the first things we did was to really nail down the different, the different attitudes of our four main elephants, our hero elephants, if you will. Roy's the playful big brother, to Detroit in a way. Each one has their own personality, and they kind of change and evolve. Studying elephants, looking at why do their ears go back at certain times? Why aren't they forward and up at other times? Just studying playful behavior by watching videos of young elephants and also adults and how they posture and do things whenever they're trying to express, hey, go away, or, a protective nature, just different things like that. We wanted to convey all of those by studying actual elephants, what they do. I'm kind of blessed because a really good friend of mine is a vet here in Tampa, and she works at the Tampa Zoo, and we are always over there with my son. And I just sat there and sketched for like 2 or 3 days straight.
Wow. Because the expressions,
just looking at the elephants, so
the expressions are amazing. I mean, when I look at
thank
them,
you
the thing that gets me is that all I ever think of is like when Crypto the Superdog's around, he thinks, and somehow he and Ace the Bat Hound, they can talk to each other somehow. But you're not doing that kind of stuff. You're making a more realistic situation.
Yeah, which makes it want a real story. Yeah.
Well, it's so sympathetic. I mean, I care about these animals because of we can see the feelings and the expressions, what's going on inside them. So I
think, exactly.
I mean, elephants can cry. I mean, we also did a lot of research, and there are things like it's actually hard to see an elephant's eyes, mm-hmm. which is one of the really tough things to convey. Only when they're young can you really kind of make out their eyes. But as they get older, they have these eyelashes that grow over their eyes, like really, really long eyelashes. And it's because the environment they're in is constantly kicking up debris and things like that. So it protects their eyes. But it makes it really tough whenever you're trying to convey behavior of an adult.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, I've got to ask you a question as far as this goes. Is this a story that's based in reality, or is this you can't possibly come up with a real story by following the elephants around. So this is kind of how much of it is based on like reality, and how much is kind of using a good imagination to kind of fill in the gaps to make it a good story?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of it is based in reality. The African poaching crisis is completely a reality, unfortunately, reality-based thing.
We have this DWST, those guys.
Yeah, Daphne Sheldrick Wildlife Trust is a great place, or Rescue is another place where we basically watch what is happening really there. Well, there's a fact where, like, in the beginning of the 20th century, there were only around there were 12 million elephants in Africa. But by the beginning of the 21st century, there's only 350,000, which is a 97% decline. Mm. So we kind of took that idea, and then the story about this warlord poaching ivory to pay for weapons and power. And then the idea of the orphanage being overrun by these warlords, which is actually a true thing as well. And we have tons of articles about sanctuaries taking a whole elephant herd. There's one, I think, maybe 2 years ago, where they moved 500 adult elephants from one country and moved them to another country. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge, huge operation. We kind of took that nugget of an idea. Instead of saying 500 adult elephant herds, we kind of narrowed it down to 14 orphaned elephants who are young, and one matriarch, to really so we can get to know those elephants, and kind of really turn it into like a Western movie, like a cattle drive. And the characters, of course, are fictional, but they're based on real events and from an amalgam of real people and real things that are happening. Mm-hmm. So like, I would say like maybe 70% is real and 30% is basically exaggerated for emotional and storytelling effect. Yeah.
The glue is the 30%.
There was I watched a movie, it was called Winged Migration one time. And it had to do with, like, geese, I think it was. And what they did was they trained these geese to stay near the flying machine. They had the camera so they could take pictures of them.
Yes, I've seen that. It's a great was it a movie or documentary?
I think it was a movie.
Okay. But maybe it was so fantastic and real, it seemed like a documentary to me.
Yeah, that's a good thing about it. Well, see, the thing of it is, you know, some people get off on the fact that, well, it isn't 100% real. But the truth of it is you got to tell a story, and that you have to use the medium you're working with. You have to make it fit the comics medium, make it interesting for comics readers to read.
Exactly. This is a real thing that's happening, but this is a story to thrill and entertain as well. So hopefully this will bring awareness to the situation, but also entertain you and thrill you with this getting involved with our characters.
Yeah, see, now, of course, I want to know what happens to these elephants.
It's entertaining.
You know, because I'm always interested when you get me liking caring. And you've made a point I've seen sometimes on the Kickstarter page where you talk about that the elephants are the main characters, not the people. Even though there are people involved.
Yes.
It's the elephants that are the focus.
Because it's really their story. You know, the human characters are, of course, major forces and are really like leading the story forward, but it's the elephant's story. Mm-hmm. It's their past, their present, their future, which leads to all the entertaining action. Mm-hmm. But and the humans involved in the story know it's all about the elephants. So when it comes to sacrificing themselves and making sure everyone gets to safety, the elephants take precedence.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. See, I don't think you get many stories like that. I think you often have stories about this kind of thing, and the elephants are kind of the side story. We're so worried about the humans interacting and how they do things and stuff that the elephants don't seem to matter as much.
Well, see, this is why, that's exactly why we wanted to go for the graphic novel format, because we wanted to tell a large scale story, but from the elephant's point of view. Now, maybe like in 5 years when movies have the perfection, like Dumbo that just came out, mm-hmm. is more of a Disney cartoon version of elephant, but you can't do the realistic view of elephants yet for a cinematic picture. And so the graphic novel really gives us the best of all worlds, where we can really tell the story from the elephant's point of view and the human's point of view, but basically have the elephants as a fully formed character with emotions and with feelings and with actions that you can really grab hold of.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I got to say, go to that first picture and you'll be hooked.
That's awesome.
It just got me. Just something. I shouldn't keep going back to that, but it just was the thing that sold me on the whole project. I started to read the other stuff afterwards, but I was already bought into it, thanks to that whole thing. So I think it's a well done, put together story with that. So, do you include like some of this information you're talking about? I noticed that you mentioned the fact that you see on the website about the fact that there's 97% reduction in mm-hmm. the, do you have like information in the book, or do you kind of focus keep on the story pretty much?
We are going to be including, so now that we've hit our goal, we have some stretch goals that we're wanting to include, and one of them is 15, you know, a few, like 12, I think, pages of facts, things like how a poach actually occurs, sort of like an infographic type thing.
What is ivory?
Exactly.
Come from? But the great thing also is it you learn a lot about this current crisis, but it's also an action adventure story. You're gonna feel for these elephants, but it's gonna take you on a ride as they're basically being chased by this vicious warlord through cities and through the savannah, through a giant dust storm where things basically take everything.
Wait for that part.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like Apocalypto, but with elephants. Yeah. So what makes it really exciting? Whenever you can tell a really passionate, true story, but also wrap it in a thrilling adventure. To me, those are my favorite type of stories. Those are my favorite type of movies and books. Mm-hmm. And I feel like with Dan's art, like all that stuff really comes alive on the page, and you'll be this thrilled and crying as you're reading it.
I was when I just read the script. So,
that's great. So, yeah, it's a great, one of those projects, I think, that comes along every once in a while. And you just got to get in there and help make happen. You know, it's just one of those things.
Yeah.
It's just
thank you very much.
So, as far as when is the book planned to come out? It looks like December of this year is when you're planning to get some things out.
We should have books in time for Christmas, in time for the holidays. So holiday season is when we want to get them to everybody. We should get them a little bit before then. The hiccup, or the one thing that's kind of we're not really sure how long it's going to take, is our printing is done overseas. So most of the printers that we got quotes back from are not based anywhere in North America. So there's a 3-month turnaround after the book is actually finished, where we actually have to, they have to be shipped over. So
the whole Kickstarter process is fascinating to me, because I come from the studio world, where I worked for like NBC or HBO, where everything's already set up. And then when I wrote for Grimm and produced Grimm, and then got the chance to do the comic book as well for Dynamite, you know, they're already a publication that has things set up. And Kickstarter is beautiful because it really lets the creators publish their book. And getting into this world of, you know, shipping and publishing and printers and all that stuff, it's really like a great subculture where you get to see and really like make the book the way you want to make it. And that's what we're doing. Like we're making it the way we want to make it, to make sure it's the best quality and the best looking and the best story. And and basically it's right now, so I'd say about like a quarter of the way done with the art. The script is completely done, but the art's about a quarter. And then Daniel's going to be working his butt off to finish it.
Yep.
And then we're going to be getting the books ourselves probably around November and start to ship them out around the end of November, beginning of December to people.
Very cool. It's just, you know, all I can say is it's just that it just sings, you know, yeah. This project.
Yes.
You know, it's a great story with great art, and that's what the comic format was ever made to do.
You know, yeah.
This is the height of it. Now, of course, that makes me ask another question. Let's say somebody missed out on get your money and stuff before the Kickstarter ends. Is Tuskers going to be available in other ways?
Yes. We've already talked about possibly putting it up on Amazon. It's funny, tomorrow we have a meeting to kind of weigh our options on that. So, but there will be a way that someone can pick it up if they missed out on the Kickstarter.
See, I would want a print copy of this. This is I love digital, don't get me wrong. I would love to have it. I think I even signed up for a digital and a print. But the one I'll read the digital and I'll save the print because the print's going to look really...
Oh, yeah. When I first started talking about this project with Daniel, I was mentioning this would look fantastic in a large format, hardcover quality book. And really the book that inspired me as I was writing this also was India, the Ethan Hawke graphic novel, yeah, Native Americans.
Yeah. That thing's gorgeous.
It's just a beautiful book, and we're aiming to have something of as high quality as that, if you're familiar with that book.
It's usually lovely. Yeah. That's going to be fantastic. Do you know what paper stock they're going to use?
Right now we're talking about 10 point or 20 or 12 point.
Okay. So it's going to be, yeah, it's going to be the color is going to come through, oh, yeah, real nicely.
Yeah. It'll be uncoated. So you'll have that, you know, the watercolors will really kind of shine. Mm-hmm. You'll get that texture and everything that was the real thing for me. The gloss usually loses the texture of watercolor. So we didn't want anything coated or anything like that on the inside. Mm-hmm. And then right now we're talking about, we've been back and forth with printers because of our stretch goals. We're talking about hardcovers now for all the books.
Ooh.
And we wanted to do the logo itself that says Tuskers is actually made out of tusks.
Mm.
So we're going to emboss it so that it actually looks like ivory tusks wow, coming up right off of the page.
Wow, because that would be lovely. I personally love hardcovers. If I have a choice between hardcover and softcover, I'll get a hardcover myself, especially in a store like this that I'm going to want to keep. You know, I want a really, really nice version to keep with me. And, of course, I hate the moment I crack it open and, you know, it's not quite pristine anymore. But, on the other hand, it would be fun to just dive right in and be lost in the story for a while.
No, this one will have signatures. It'll have the whole – we even are talking about a ribbon bookmark that's going to be that orange color that we use in the pages.
Oh.
I mean, we're going to make sure that it's a beautiful book. Mm-hmm. Inside now.
Wow, because it's just, are you guys going to know before too long about the hardcover stuff? Because
we're getting really close. I mean, we talked about, right now we're just waiting for the final quotes back tomorrow, funny enough, on what the costing will be so that we know what price point to put up there for that stretch goal. And now that we're in, 8 or 9 days left in the campaign, I think we can meet it. We're close enough that I think it's going to happen. So
I'd love that, because I'd even up my pledge to get a hardcover. You know, I'd be glad to add something to it to make sure that I get a hardcover, because this will just definitely be it. Oh, gosh, it's just, it's gorgeous on all these different levels, and it's just, it's something worth having.
Well, I appreciate that.
So
yeah, I'm so lucky to have a partner like Daniel in this project, really, to bring my words come alive and really bring the emotion to these characters. And if you just visit the page, you'll just see how the color and the art, it just perfectly brings everything alive.
Well, not to get, and your story helps a lot too with this too.
Big time. I mean, the words are really that's the crux. That's what starts everything off. If I don't have anything to go on, you know, the storyline is really what gets me. You can conjure these images in your head just reading through it. And it's one of those where when I first got the script, I started reading it, and I read scripts all the time. And a lot of them are, you'll get through like 4 or 5 pages and then it's kind of a slog. And this one, I just tore through the whole thing, and it's 128, 132 pages. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, I just gobbled it up. It was really, really a good read.
Which is one thing that like, writing the Grimm comic book and working for television actually helped with Javier and myself to always, you know, keep the action going, always keep the momentum going and never slowing down. It's,
yeah,
I think was a big help with writing this.
But the pacing was great too. I mean, you guys are hitting like all the things at the right times, you know, the tender moments, the heart wrenching moments, they happen. They're, you know, you have the surprises, all those are in there. And that's the stuff that makes a really great story.
And at this point, I want to jump in and say, I miss Grimm on Friday nights.
Thank you.
That used to be one of my shows that every Friday night, if I wasn't home, I made sure it recorded because when I got home, I wanted to watch it before I hit the bed that night because it was just one of those great shows.
Thank you. It was a very special show to work on as well. So I miss it as well. It was great people behind the camera. It really became a family. So it was a fantastic place to work.
Yeah, it was good stuff. Daniel, what other stuff have you worked on? I want to mention that.
Most of Marvel's... I don't know if you're familiar with Marvel's Prelude books that they do.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime a movie is about to coming out, they do a lot of, like one-shots that are kind of prepping people what the movie is about. So, for instance, with Captain America, when Winter Soldier came out, they had a whole backstory on who Bucky was and what his past life was. And I would illustrate those type of stories for them.
Cool.
I also did a lot of basically laying out Infinite comics, those... active 3D versions that they've been dodging. So I would lay those out for their artists that kind of show how they make images move, make expressions change, things like that.
Great.
Aside from those, I also have done covers for Valiant recently. I just did Exo Manowar and Bloodshot.
Great.
I guess my own stories that I have up there right now, both on Comixology and in print as well.
Now, what's your website? You have the, it's your name, right?
Yeah, danielgovar.com.
G-O-V-A-R, just in case people worry about that. Now, how about you, Mark?
Is in Victor. Yeah.
How about you, Mark? Do you have any social media that we could follow you with?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram, and I'm kind of embarrassed by the name, but, you know, it was a childhood nickname, so I'm sticking with it. If you're on Instagram, you can find me on Red Muppet 007, REDMUPPET 007.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah.
And I'm actually on Instagram too. I that's probably where my biggest audience, I guess, would be.
Cool. Cool. Because I look at your website, Daniel, and I see some more of the art. There's other paintings of elephants and cats and frogs and other good things.
Oh, right.
All kinds of stuff on there.
Yeah,
he does an amazing dragon. If you ever need anything dragon based, his dragons are some of the best.
That's hilarious. On my drafting table right now, I have five dragons. Five dragon illustrations. I do a lot of fantasy illustration as well.
Oh, cool.
So a lot there's a lot of non comic work that I do on the side.
Isn't that interesting? This story hits your strengths too. You know, very realistic story. Like that too.
Yeah, it's really funny. The children's book I just did, we had we did remarks in the books, and all of the remarks, I think we did 240 remarks over the course of a month and a half, 2 months.
Wow.
And in that time, I think I drew 240 separate animals, and they were realistic illustrations of each animal. So I kind of really got to study every animal and their anatomy, and it was a lot of fun. Also daunting.
I bet.
For the sequel of Tuskers, we'll do elephants team with dragons to take revenge.
Oh gosh, yeah.
That'll be fun.
Now they're back for more.
Well, it's called Tuskers. It's on Kickstarter right now, and I highly recommend. Even though they've gotten their goal, there are wonderful stretch goals coming, and possibly even that great hardcover concept. I love the thought of that. So, if you want to support that, get out there and support this good thing. Does any of the money basically goes to the production of the book? There's not any money that goes to like wildlife conservation or any of that stuff.
With Kickstarter, you're not actually allowed to do that.
Okay.
They actually have a thing against you can't donate it. None of the money can go to a charity organization. And I think it has to do more with tax purposes than anything.
Okay.
It's something that we really discussed because we were like, maybe we could have a adopt an elephant. And then there, but then we read this whole little thing where, yeah, you cannot actually have any live animals in, involved in your Kickstarter. So.
Mm. Yeah. But the main goal also of this is us to also to bring awareness to people who don't really know. Because one of the big problems with poaching is the people who get it in China or even in America, people who still get ivory, don't understand that in order to get the ivory, they have to kill the elephant. They just think that a lot of people think it's just fingernails that this grub you can cut off and grow back. And so a lot of this is to basically get awareness for people who like thrilling adventures, who like movie type stories, but may not know much about the soul of an elephant or the story of what's going on in Africa. So bringing awareness is a big part of why we're doing this as well.
I confess I was woefully ignorant until I read the script of how poaching actually occurs. I didn't realize, you know, chainsaws are involved and just how it actually happens. I always, you know, okay, wow, that's terrible that they're killing them for their tusks. But I didn't realize that, you know, they're alive a lot of times during it. I mean, it's brutal, brutal what happens. And the scenes that are left over are just as brutal. So it's definitely something that I feel like American audiences and, you know, just audiences in general really need to kind of open their eyes. When such a huge, majestic creature is down to 3% of their numbers from just 100 years ago, that's really sad.
Mm. Wow, because I didn't know any of that either. That's amazing.
Yeah, and just 4 days ago, 9 tons of ivory was seized in
Vietnam. I saw that.
Now considered like an absolutely huge haul. So it's, you know, it's still going on and people still need to be aware of it, which is unfortunately all too real.
Hopefully this book will help raise awareness for that, because it's not only a great book, it's also got a social awareness to it, which is something we can always use. So again, it's called Tuskers and it's on Kickstarter, and you've got until Thursday, April 11th, at 3 o'clock Eastern time, must be noon Western time, to get out and support this thing. They've got their goals, so that means good stretch goals are on the way. So this is the time to dive in. If you haven't already, be sure to get in there and support it, because it can certainly use your support, and this is the kind of book that we want to see more of. So I think you guys are doing a wonderful thing. This is a terrific project. I can't wait to get my hands on the book to be able to sit down and read it. But, you know, keep up the great stuff, and I can't wait to see this thing. It just looks great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. From border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea, it's Zero Hour. The year is 1941, and every able-bodied American has answered the call, including a handsome duo of comic book artists who've taken it upon themselves to tell the tale of an American traitor.
That's not entirely accurate.
Brothers, this is your Japanese sister, the voice of truth.
Get Tokyo Rose.
Yes, Tokyo Rose, a Japanese agent who hosted the radio program called Zero Hour. Japanese propaganda aimed at demoralizing our boys in the Pacific.
Actually, her name was Aiba Toguri, and she was only one of several broadcasters. But this story isn't just for Americans. It's for everyone who believes in justice and freedom and just good old-fashioned storytelling.
Well, you heard it here, folks. Is Aiba Toguri an American patriot or an American traitor? Stay tuned to find out. Till then, good night and good luck.
It's great to welcome to the podcast Andrew Russell Burkett and Andre Fratino from Tokyo Rose Zero Hour. Has a Kickstarter going on, and from Atheris Entertainment. Let's see, Andrew, let's start with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Good. And what's your role in Atheris?
So I run Atheris. It's started as a board game publishing studio, and we're trying to branch out to do more comics and that sort of thing. So this is our first project that we're working on in the graphic novel space. Andre has been a friend of mine for several years, and so we decided to work together on it. So cool. I'm excited about it.
And Andre Fratino, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Wayne. How are you?
Good. And your involvement largely has to do with the book. You're one of the creative forces behind the book.
Yeah, I'm the writer and creator of Tokyo Rose Zero Hour. And for the book project, I'm partnering with a longtime friend of mine, Kate Casanow, and she is the artist for the project.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Why don't we start off with talking about the Kickstarter, because it's underway and that's a big deal to get this done. As I was looking at it, you guys pointed me to the make sure we had the right one. The deadline is May 2nd at 11:59 p.m. It's a Thursday. And so we want to get people to go. It's called Tokyo Rose, and there's a colon, Zero Hour, a graphic novel of treason and intrigue. And it's got there on Kickstarter. Why don't you talk about it, Andrew, as far as doing the Kickstarter program? Because it looks like you've got a pretty good-sized goal on there, and you're I think at this point when we're recording it, you're pretty well on your way to get it.
Yeah, so I've done a few Kickstarters in the past. So my company, like I said, I started with board games. I've always been a writer, and that was sort of what I wanted to do. And somehow I weirdly stumbled upon making a board game one day, and I just kind of did it as a passion project. And I went to school at the University of Florida, and that's actually where I met Andre in Gainesville, Florida, which is where he was from and where I went to school. And so I was there, decided to start this project, and I won a pitch competition. They sent me to Chicago, and I was like, this is so cool. And so then I just kept working on the business, and eventually I did my first Kickstarter, and it ended up raising over $20,000 on Kickstarter. But actually the day it funded, my car, the tire popped, and I was in Savannah, Georgia, which is where Andre lives now. And so I had nowhere to go. All the tire shops were closed. So I had to sleep on Andre's couch. And then when I woke up in the morning, he was like, congrats on your Kickstarter funding. I was like, what? that's how my Kickstarter story started. So it makes sense for me and Andre to work together again after all of that. So I funded three board game projects. And then now we're working on Tokyo Rose. And so we launched at 11 a.m. this morning. It's 9 p.m. So it's been a few hours. And we're at $2,500 in funding with 50 backers. So we're doing fairly well. We're at like 33% of our goal. So it's definitely looking promising that we're going to hit it. And so we're super excited about it.
So it's obvious that Andrew and I can't change a tire of a car, but we can actually start a Kickstarter.
Well, that's the takeaway.
You need to start a Kickstarter for tire repair is what you need to do. That would be a good way to do it.
A comic book about changing tires. That would be the next one.
I'll write that.
Yeah, that would be good stuff. So as far as you've done three, is what you're saying, three Kickstarters, or have you done more than that?
So I've done three for my own game, so under my brand name. So I did a game called Cul-de-Sac Conquest, and then a game called Mewin Crops, and the last one was called Supernatural Socks. It's a weird game about lost socks. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to do your laundry. I make very strange games, which is why I'm a writer, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing Kickstarter consulting. So I realized that I had learned a lot, and a lot of new creators have a lot of difficulty with the platform. And Kickstarter is really awesome, and it can be a great medium, but it's really difficult to learn the platform for first-time creators. If you don't have an audience going into it, a lot of creators fail their campaigns. And so I figured that because I had learned some of that stuff, that I could start helping new creators and make sure that they're projects don't fail, essentially. And so Tokyo Rose is a relaunch. The original campaign wasn't able to fund, so I just helped Andre kind of refine some of the offerings so that people would understand how cool the story is. And, you know, more eyes on the campaign means, you know, more backers and more likelihood of funding. And so that was kind of the goal here.
Very cool, very cool. And one of the things I love about Kickstarter is it helps make stories that we probably wouldn't be able to read any other way available to us. You know, as I was mentioning before we started to record, there are reports to say that sometimes Kickstarter is like number two behind Marvel. And, you know, I believe it because I am constantly being, you know, going out to Kickstarter and finding new and interesting projects to support. And I was glad to hear about this one, which is really, really cool about that. So, well, why don't we, Andre, dive into Tokyo Rose Zero Hour? Why don't you give a description of what the graphic novel is about?
Sure. So Tokyo Rose Zero Hour is based off the true story of Iva Tagori. She was a Japanese-American who was visiting her sick aunt in Japan just before Pearl Harbor, before the attack. in 1941. She was kind of an envoy for her American family. She was a UCLA graduate. She was born on the 4th of July. Her parents raised her to be, you know, a good American. And after Pearl Harbor took place, she couldn't get back to the States. And the Japanese authorities tried to get her to renege her American citizenship. She said absolutely not. She refused, and she ended up on the streets. And to make a living, she ended up taking a job at a radio propaganda station that was doing propaganda against the Americans. And it was actually run by POWs. So, you know, Allied forces who were captured were forced to work at this place. And one Australian major came up with the idea of essentially doing a radio show that would feature her as the host. And she had never done radio hosting before, but they liked the way that she talked, and they came up with a way to kind of subvert the propaganda so that it wasn't so harsh and maybe a little more entertaining. Mm-hmm. And this led to Iva, you know, being able to make not only a living, but to support POWs in the camps. She actually dedicated money and food to them. And despite all that, when the war ended, she was tried as a traitor. They saw her as the infamous Tokyo Rose. And that's where our story kind of takes place. It kind of takes us through the story of Iva, how she became the infamous Tokyo Rose, and what was her final fate.
It's interesting because, you know, I'm always fascinated by historical things like this. Did you have to do a lot of research to find out what really happened?
Yes. I read several books. Funny enough is, I can't tell you exactly where I stumbled on the story of Tokyo Rose. I had heard of the, you know, I'm a big World War II buff. I love reading about World War II. And I just always heard of the Tokyo Rose character. I think the first time I heard it was in a Cary Grant movie, Operation Petticoat. You hear, you know, a Tokyo Rose character speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I tried to find some books on her, and there's some great documentation, but very little of it. So surprisingly, you know, Iva Tagori is an understated character of World War II, despite the fact that she was, you know, at the time, one of the most expensive, you know, court case trials against a traitor in U.S. history. But yeah, I read quite a few books, as many as I could get a hold of, which wasn't, like I said, that many. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that I knew as much of the facts about who Iva Tagori was inside and out.
It's interesting because the book is supposed to be 75-page hardcover graphic novel, and you're going to answer, you listed some questions, which I kind of, it got me really intrigued. Who was Tokyo Rose really? What did she stand for? Who did she support? Was she a traitor or a hero? And like most reality things, it's not necessarily, you know, black and white. So we'll see about that. I'm just fascinated to see it. Now, speaking of black and white, though, it looks like the artwork in here is done largely in black and white from the stuff that I've seen. Is that true, or am I just seeing, looking at some representations that didn't get colored?
No, at this point, it's a black and white graphic novel. You know, the stretch goal for the Kickstarter is to put it into color. But, you know, traditionally, I've always been a fan of the black and white graphic novels. Most of my other work is done in traditional black and white. And, you know, I find that it can sometimes be really classic, especially when you're talking about a story that, you know, is featured largely in a black and white world, you know, as far as footage is concerned. But our goal is to put it into color. We're just going to have hopefully make that stretch goal at a later date.
Mm-hmm. Now, why is it called Zero Hour? Sometimes you just say Tokyo Rose or story or something. Why choose the phrase Zero Hour?
Well, Zero Hour is actually the name of the radio propaganda show that Iva was on. She was on the Zero Hour. So I felt like it would make a good subtitle for the book, just to kind of, you know, point into that direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Everything I see about it looks really great. Now, one of the things, and I think this is something that we could probably ask Andrew about, was there's a great video that accompanies the Kickstarter thing. Did you put that together? Were you the guy who handled all that?
I did not.
I'm going to give credit over to Joe Volpe. He is another friend of mine who graduated. He's actually Kate's husband. But he runs his own company called Starland Media. And Starland Media was responsible for the video for this Kickstarter and the last Kickstarter that we did. So yeah, that goes to credit to him. Everything else though is credited to Andrew over there as far as how we set everything up and how we structured it and everything.
So. For this one, Andre did shorten the video a little bit. So I think the original version was maybe a minute or two longer. And so he shortened it up a little bit so that, you know, people finish the whole video.
Mm-hmm. Was that a problem that they had in the past that people didn't get through the whole video?
It's a problem with Kickstarter normally. Attention spans are pretty low, and so any video over like a minute tends to not get watched fully.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Something for us to remember. And I'll say, Andre, let's get to... I'm fascinated because I love history type stuff, and this is a subject I don't know much about. I knew there was a Tokyo Rose, but more than that, I didn't know. So this is going to be really an educational thing for me. That's why I was asking about the research. I was just curious to find out, you know, some people, when they write historical things, they get a little carried away, shall we say. I was just kind of curious how close you kept to the facts of her story.
You know, I tried to keep pretty close to it, Wayne. You know, when it comes to writing these historical pieces and you're basing it off real people, you know, historical creative license is great, you know, to be able to kind of push the story in the right ways to make it, you know, an entertaining story. But for the most part, Ivan Tagore's story tells itself. You know, every turn in the story, you didn't need any real extra added help. So, you know, I wanted to make sure that I had all the facts as much as I can. There's a little elaboration here and there, but for the most part, you know, the story is close to reality as I was able to educate myself in.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you have to do certain things to make the story, you know, readable as far as the comics format, things like that.
Right.
So you have to do those kinds of things. I expect that. I'm just always worried that, you know, a book will come out, and I've run across a couple in my day where they weren't exactly factual on what they wanted. It was kind of what they kind of wished it was. And so that's why I always ask, is this really, you know, close to the truth? Because that's important to me.
Well, you know, like, yeah, and that's important to me too. You know, as a history buff and as a fan of historical fiction, you know, when you're dealing with this kind of stuff, I always like to write with the historian in mind, because nothing is more annoying if you're already familiar with the story and then you listen or you read it or you watch a Netflix, you know, dramatization of it or something, and you're just sitting there going like, I know that's not how that happened, or that wouldn't have happened then, or this doesn't make, what is this, you know? And nothing takes you out of the story faster than that. Mm-hmm. So the stories that I like to tell are the ones that are versatile in both ways, that they'll entertain the newcomers who aren't familiar with the story, but it'll also entertain the people who are historians, who are familiar with the times, who might be familiar with Iva, who will be able to read this and say, you know, for the most part, yes, it's pretty on the facts, pretty true.
Well, see, that's encouraging. I'm really dying to read it now because I don't know anything about this. And I love when I find out stuff through this kind of stuff. I think comics are one of the great ways. You've got an unlimited budget as far as special effects and scenery and costumes go. It's all in your guy's imagination who is doing it.
Right. So there are no expense. So.
Say that again, would you?
I was joking. I was just quoting John Hammond from Jurassic Park. We spare no expense.
Because I'm always fascinated by these kinds of things. And I love what I don't know. If I know something, I'm much less interested. But if I don't know, I think that's great. Now, let me get back to you, Andrew. And I want to ask you, this is the first book under your company. You've been doing games and stuff, but this is the first time you're doing a publishing project?
Yeah, that's correct. I've wanted to get into comics for a while, mainly like as a writer myself. I wanted to write comics, and then I had a few other people come to me that they wanted me to publish their comics, and I felt like I wasn't quite ready to launch it under my own banner. I wanted to work with someone that had already produced comics and, you know, knew the production. And so Andre had successful Kickstarter for his first project, Simon Says, which is another historical book that's awesome. And Image just picked that one up. I'm sure he'll tell you more about that. But when I knew like Andre, and I wanted to work with him already on other projects potentially in the future, and I figured that relaunching Tokyo Rose would be a good starting point for us working together. And then it also kind of launches this new imprint of my company that will allow me to get into the comic and graphic novel space more.
Cool. Cool. Now, I've got to ask you, as you look at your website, I noticed there's snakes everywhere. And of course, the logo has a snake. What's the, why the snakes? What's up with that?
All right. So, when I started the company, I was making, I'm a car nut. I have a 1979 Camaro Z28. Mm-hmm. And actually kind of a little backstory on how Andre and I started talking is he told me that he had a replica of Herbie. And so I was like, I have to go see that. And so we went and walked out and looked at his car. And so that's honestly how we met. So I meet car people all the time. That's pretty much the only way I meet people. And so I was making this automotive themed game. So that was the first game I ever made. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to name all these unique cars I was having in the game after snakes, but I couldn't use Viper or Cobra or anything like that because obviously those were taken. So I named the first one the Latin name for the bush viper, which is one of the most deadly snakes in the world, which is Athras. And so I named that the first card in our first game. And so when I later, I didn't have a company name forever. I just didn't have one. And then eventually I was like, I'm going to name the company after the first card in the first game and no one will know it except me, but it will matter to me. And so then the snakes in the logo and that continued.
Well, I got a huge kick out of this. It's sort of a cartoonish thing. They're sitting around playing games. And I love there's a thing that says rules.
My designer went crazy with that one. I thought that they would be funny ads that would get people's attention, which they do. And so like a lot of board game creators, they'll get lazy and their advertisements are like just a picture of the box. And I was like, if I do something funny and different, then people are going to notice it. Mm-hmm. So I make all of our stuff snake related. So like different, there's all kinds of different snake ones. So there's the snakes playing games. We're going to do like snakes on a plane joke version, snakes like building the pyramids, all kinds of crazy stuff. So,
oh, wow. Okay. Well, something to keep our attention to. And why don't you go ahead and give people the name of the website just while we're at it.
It's Atheris Entertainment. So Atheris Entertainment.com.
Yeah, that'll be good to do. Now, get back to you, Andre. He brought up a book that I just saw. Forbes did an article on your book, Simon Says. Talk about what that book is about.
So that was my first Kickstarter a couple of years ago. It is based off another true life character during the during World War II. His name was Simon Wiesenthal. Mm-hmm. He was a Jewish artist who became one of the most prolific Nazi hunters. They called him the Jewish James Bond. So we kind of took that idea and ran with it a little harder. So it's a graphic novel about a fictionalized Nazi hunter who teams up with another gentleman, I can't give away too much, and they hunt down Nazis in a post-World War II world. Mm-hmm. So we did that Kickstarter back in 2017, and we were successful in that one, and that led to Image Comics picking us up. I was the writer on that, and my wonderful artist for that project was Jesse Lee, a good friend of mine. It was his first comic book, and he just blew it out of the water. It's gorgeous. And Forbes just did a really great interview with us that came out today, the same day as the Kickstarter.
Isn't that wild? That's great timing.
Really.
When that all works out like that. Now, I've got to ask you, it looks like that book is largely black and white, gray tones to it. There's a little bit of red now and again that in the pages that they show in there. And I haven't seen it. I'm going to have to get a hold of it. But mm-hmm. Talk about that. Is this, again, the black and white appeal to you as far as the content goes?
Yeah, well, let me get a little more honest with you in that sense. You know, in one side, I am a big fan of black and white. I like it, its simplicity and its classicness. It's just clean and it can be really elegant and beautiful. But in another way, I think it was also, you know, partly it was, you know, economical, you know, in the sense that some graphic novels, everyone I've ever worked on in particular, you know, it's just been more economical for sales and prints. So, you know, as I said, with this one, for Simon Says, we definitely wanted to go black and white because we wanted to do the tinges of red as a sort of homage to Schindler's List. Mm. And how, you know, Spielberg had done just the little girl in the red sweater. But, you know, largely when it comes to these projects, you know, printing costs are always something to keep in mind. But we are definitely hoping that with Tokyo Rose, we can bring a little more color to it.
That'd be cool. Now, do you know when Simon Says is going to get started with Image?
Yeah, Image will release the book in September 2019. So it's coming up and it'll be 120 pages. Mm-hmm. It's a first, so we're hoping we're going to be able to tell some more stories with Simon, but it does leave you with a slight cliffhanger, so hopefully we'll bring in the crowd around for another Simon Says Go as well.
So this is like a graphic novel.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a graphic novel.
Oh, cool. So I thought it was going to – sometimes they take graphic novels and break them up into individual issues and stuff, but I'm happy to know it's all in one place because I'd love to – got me all intrigued. I got to have to read this thing because – Again, this is a historical time that I'm always fascinated by. I'll be turning the channel and I'll see stuff about Nazis and stuff, and I got to stop and look. What's it about? What are they talking about? You know, kind of stuff. I'll share with you one quick story that just got my interest going. There was a thing in England. There was something called the Black Book, and it was the Nazis had sat down and decided which people they would let live and which people they would not let live when they took over England. And it was all in a black book. I remember my head spinning around going like, what? I said, I'd like to know more about that. Those kinds of things just get me. I've got to know those kinds of things. So this book, this really sounds like a great step. And you're saying there's more than just this one story too.
Oh yeah. Well, for Simon Says, you know, if it's a success, we hope to bring that into several other editions, other volumes. So I have at least six full books worth of content that I'd like to explore with Simon Says.
Oh, wow.
But with Tokyo Rose, it's kind of a one shot. It's the beginning, middle, and end of Iva Tagori's story. So.
Oh, cool. Well, they both sound really good. Let's talk back about Tokyo Rose for a second. I want to ask Andrew, as far as when you say you're helping with the Kickstarter and managing that kind of stuff, do you handle the social media for it as well, or does Andre do some of that? How do you guys manage? Because right now this is a critical time to keep the communication going. Are you doing most of that, or is that something Andre does?
So we're kind of both doing that right now. So we're working together. We both have access to the social media accounts, so we're both posting. And obviously, I've been posting on all of my channels as well. My gaming page has a lot more likes, so I've been posting there and running Facebook ads, and I just started a Reddit advertisement. I've never done that before, so I wanted to see if there's any return. I don't know. But we posted in the Reddit graphic novel group, and we got a few backers from that, and so we figured that, you know, I might as well try an ad and see what happened.
Yeah, because I haven't backed it yet, but I will once we get done talking. I'll go out there and pledge something.
We appreciate that.
Because I'm just, like I said, and Andre, this is, you've packaged it just perfectly for me. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I love. I love when I don't understand the situation. You're going to help me understand it better. And this Tokyo Rose to me just, and I also wanted to mention too, in the fact that I'm always fascinated by female lead characters or stories about women. Because, right, you know, comic books tend to focus on white males, you know, blondes, all that kind of stuff. And you can, if a lot of the times I get to talk with folks, I always treasure when I get to talk to a woman creator. You know, I always think that's a lot of fun. But talking about, you know, I don't want to get too much, I don't want to spoil too much, but on the other hand, as far as her as a character, I mean, was she ahead of her time? I mean, did she have things that were going on that we might relate to today in it more than maybe they did during her time?
Yeah, well, you know, I think what's important to not forget about Iva Tagori, from what I've understood in the research, was that, you know, this is a woman who had to deal with prejudice, the same as a lot of minorities have to deal with prejudice and racism. And, you know, from the look of her, you know, she's Japanese. That's what they thought. That's what the Americans thought they saw. That's what the Japanese thought they saw. But what's important to remember is that Iva was 100% American. I mean, this is a woman who wanted to be a zoologist. She went to UCLA. She was in love with Jimmy Stewart. You know, she had friends, crushes. You know, she liked she really wasn't a big fan of rice at all, which is pretty bad when you're living in Japan. So, you know, the funny thing that the thing I found interesting about it was that, you know, Iva was just a real free spirit for that time, I think. And she never blamed anybody for her faults in life. She didn't blame, you know, the Japanese or the Americans, the people who prosecuted her and persecuted her. You know, she managed to always keep kind of an upbeat nature to it. And I think that's refreshing, too, you know, and something that we don't really see a lot in today's world. You know, everybody wants to blame everybody for everything. But here's Iva took, you know, her life in her own hands and survived the way that she could survive. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's valuable to everybody of every walk of life and every type. And, you know, I just felt that when I read this story about Iva Tagori, and I realized, just like Simon Wiesenthal, who gets a lot more publicity and his right, you know, I realized that this was a character that definitely was relevant today. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have movies that are telling, you know, a woman's, you know, character a lot more prominently now ever than before, and we're looking at diversity in storytelling, you know, here is somebody who checkmarks all of those needs. And this is a woman who predates everything 70 years, you know. This was, in my opinion, a hero, a Captain Marvel before Captain Marvel, in a way. So, and I think whether you see her as a traitor or you see her as a war hero, an unsung war hero, I think the most important thing to take away from it is that Iva was very much her own human being, and she didn't let anybody really guide her one way or the other in that.
Wow. See, now I have to know what happened. How did she, how did she react to what happened? Because obviously she was arrested and must have gone on trial or something. So what happened? I mean, see, I don't spoil anything for me.
I mean, we need to get this Kickstarter going. We can't spoil it.
Well, let me tell you, it's just a great story. And I'm just dying to know what kind of things happened. It's interesting because I think it was recently, I think George Takei from Star Trek came out with a story about they had his whole family was taken into a like a prison camp in California.
Yeah, he
was out there. So that's kind of something related to that. It's the timing couldn't be better as far as that goes, because, you know, there's Mr. Takei out there talking about this very same time period, and you get a chance to come in and tell a story too with it. It's just,
and that's one other thing I got to say, Wayne, is that, you know, we are getting to the point now where, you know, those people who lived during the, you know, World War II are fading out. They are, you know, passing on. It's at a point now where our grandchildren aren't familiar with these stories, and to them, you know, to the next generation coming out, World War II might as well have been Civil War, you know, for all they care. I mean, or for all they know, you know, they're not getting a chance to hear these firsthand accounts. So it's really important for those of us who have heard the firsthand accounts from our grandparents and from our ancestors and our veterans to still be able to tell this story in a relevant way that is, you know, very much for the next modern reader.
Did you ever read the book Maus, M-A-U-S?
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. That was one of my first books.
That was a fantastic book. You talk about the stories, and this was a case where there was a son talking to the father. I think it was. I don't think it was a grandson. I think it was a son. And they were talking about what happened during World War II. And I was just completely enraptured by that book. And I just know I'm going to be the same with this. I already want to know, is she still alive? I don't spoil it, because I want to read the book. Because I got to get the hold of the book and see what's going on with that. I can't wait for this stuff to come.
And I also wanted to take a chance to say, like, you know, the artist I have working on this, Kate Cassanow, I've known Kate for almost, you know, 15 years now. She's an amazing artist. She's worked with Oni Press, with Hokea Entertainment. She just recently had a book come out this past year called Form of a Question, where she did the illustration work for that. So great artist. This has been a long time dream come true for me to be able to work on a book with her. And her artistic style, really soft line work, really ornate details. It's just, this is a dream team between Andrew, her, you know, and me. I really am excited to see this Kickstarter blow up.
So you bring an interesting point up, though. How long have you been working on this project? You said you did research, and that takes some time. And, you know, how did this work? I mean, how did you bring the whole thing together? How did it take years, or how did it happen?
Well, it took a few years. I would say that Tokyo Rose has been percolating for about 3 years now, probably a year before we did the Simon Says Kickstarter. But last year was when we finally had everything come together. In December, we had you know, Kate do the illustrations after she finished her last project. We had finalized the script. We had put the Kickstarter together. And I think that was actually one of our downfalls in our rush of just having everything come to a head. We put that Kickstarter out, and I think it was just a little too quick, a little too rushed, and probably not at the best of timing either, which is why it's been great having Andrew on board, because Andrew's really sort of taken, you know, what we want to achieve, you know, funding-wise, and really fine-tuned it and honed it and polished it into, you know, what it is now.
I have to tell you, my experience with people with Kickstarters is usually the first one doesn't make it. And I don't know if Andrew comments on that or not, but I know a lot of people who have done Kickstarters and the first one does not make it. And after they learn from the first one, then they come back with a little more information and the ability to make it happen. I mean, is that accurate, Andrew?
It's crazy. Kickstarter has, I don't have the data in front of me, so I don't know the exact numbers, but they have data on the amount of projects that fund based upon how many projects the creator has done in the past. Mm-hmm. And it goes up substantially. So the first project maybe is like 50%. And then when you have five Kickstarters, then doing your sixth Kickstarter is like an 80% chance you fund or something crazy mm-hmm. like that. The jump, once you've done a lot, is so high, because a lot of it's audience building. It's obviously creating social media and engaging with the community and all that kind of stuff. But it's also a lot of just like understanding best practices and what you need to do. And so, like I said, I think the difficulty for a lot of people is it's overwhelming. You get all this potential information you see online, and you know, you can Google Kickstarter advice and like 8 million things I'm sure pop up, and everyone's saying something different, I'm sure. And you know, it's difficult. And I know with my first Kickstarter, I had no idea what I was doing. I was like, oh, okay, hopefully this funds. and so I think that's the problem. And over the years, obviously Kickstarter's been building since 2008. Mm-hmm. It's gotten more and more competitive. So many companies have realized, like, and especially like comics and board games and projects that are real creative endeavors, it's people who are writers and artists that come up with these projects, and they don't really know the business end of things normally. And so they have this really great idea and a beautiful product, but they don't know how to market it. And that's what I find is typically the case, is you have a lot of these creators that on their first project, they just don't understand the marketing. And then once they develop and understand that, their second, third campaign, et cetera, you know, have a lot better chance of funding.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, see, that's good information, I think, for people. I was just talking with a group of folks that were doing their first one, and they're trying to get it to be successful, and it's a great project, and I'd love to see it succeed, but I'm just worried about, you know, first ones always seem to be a little bit of a struggle, so I'm hopeful for them, but I told them, if you don't get it the first time, don't get discouraged.
You know, I was lucky that my first one, you know, was a success. It was just perfect timing, I think.
Oh.
But the first Tokyo Rose, you know, that was my second Kickstarter. It was a heartache that we didn't get to where we wanted to get to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, everyone has said, you know, sometimes it's totally fine for your Kickstarter to go a second or even third time. Mm-hmm. And with Andrew's help, we were already at 25% funding on the first day, which was nowhere near what both Simon Says and the first round of Tokyo Rose were ever were close to. So if this is any indication, hopefully we will just go straight up, up and up.
Well, it's just a great graphic novel. I love the look of it. I love the subject matter. I'm engrossed. I've got to know what happens now. So I've got to get that. I don't know. I'm going to definitely back it on here, but I might still get an image copy just to, so I can sit down and read the whole thing, because I love these kinds of things. I want to know more. I just don't know enough. So this is one of those things that's going to really fill in that little bit of information. The big thing about her, she's got a very complex story, looks like, and lots of things going on. So I'm going to really be fascinated to read this. And I think you guys are doing a great job. I can't wait. I hope it gets to be color. That would be wonderful. Not that I also agree. I like black and white a lot of the time, but as far as like the market goes, some people prefer color. So
we would love to bring it to you in color. So, you know, the more we can, more people we can get back in it, and the more
people we're working on it.
Yeah. And we keep the momentum. Hopefully it will be in color, and we will bring in an amazing colorist to work on this project. So
excellent. I hope so, because this is one of those projects that I really feel a lot of passion for, because like I said, I love knowing more than I do, and this is one of those gaps in my knowledge that I'd love to fill in. It's called Tokyo Rose 0 Hour, and if you go to Kickstarter, you'll find it there. And make sure you get to the current one. He talked about there was one that's in there. It still shows up a little, unfortunately, but go to the, make sure you're going to the current one that ends on May 2 at 11:59 Eastern Time, and be sure to back it, because it's just one of those projects. I'd love to see this one go. I'd like to see more of the other. I got to get the other book too that Simon says I got to get after that. So I'll get a hold of that too, because these are the kinds of things that just, you know, grab me and won't let me go. And I've got to, I want to know more about these things. So I think that, you know, I think Andrew, you're doing a wonderful job getting the word out. And Andre, I think the book looks fantastic. I can't wait to get the other one too. So I hope you guys keep up the great work, and man, keep this stuff going.
Thank you. We'll try.
And that's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.